Warm welcome to all of you who are here for this regular noon session of the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, and especially a warm welcome to the Southern Alberta viewing audience. This is a regular meeting of the Council of Public Affairs. I should say irregular in the sense that we have three speakers today who are governors of us all. My name is Gordon Campbell. I'm your moderator today. I'd like to mention here that while I am the moderator, I did not have the pleasure of arranging this meeting today. It was done by Diane King. All the work that was done in, as you know, to put together a meeting of this kind with all the 100 details that were involved were thought about and done efficiently, always, by Diane. I'd like you to recognize her. Again, will you stand up? We have had a number of distinguished speakers on this podium in our day, 30 years, 8 years, consistent now, but it's the first time we've had three senators, and I want them to stand, I want us and the television audience to see what they look like, and give them a warm welcome. Will the three senators stand? We'll introduce you. We are sitting at three different tables, so we'll meet three different varieties of people through the question period. About the procedures of SACWA meeting for newcomers. The cost of this meeting is $8. We are cheap, but we don't make our guests pay. Joyce has been here so often, we have to say she's a regular, but we'll let her off for today. We have a basket coming around. Our treasurer will pick up the dollars, and if you care to leave extra, that's good too. That'll help us along. Our speakers have 10 minutes today, each to make their initial statements prior to lunch, and then we can feast over their issues that they raise and discussions together at our table. Then at the conclusion of their speeches, we will have a 20-minute lunch or so. Some of the sandwiches and things are very familiar at this table, maybe for 30 years. Some people walk backwards to get those pink jobs that are on the table. We'll have those lunches, then we will resume our work with our speakers. Well, the senators will indicate the topic for the day. You are free to ask questions that are burning on your mind about issues that you care about and want to address. Raise to our lawmakers, because you raise it not only to them but to the rest of the community, Southern Alberta and beyond. Be sure, of course, to make your preliminary wind-up introductions ever so brief. Because this is a special meeting, our normal closing hour will be extended to 2 o'clock. I should tell you that our partners in this enterprise, SACPA Enterprise, are the Lethbridge Herald, University of Lethbridge, Shaw TV, and Erickson's Restaurant. SACPA maintains a website, www.sacpa Canada, where you can always hear or see the exciting things that go on up here every Thursday, noon at 12 o'clock. For those of you who want to receive weekly notices of programs or emails or in the post, there's a little form on the table. Will you please pass it around, put your name, email address on it if you want to receive regular notices of these meetings. If you can do it now and give it to the treasurer when she comes around, that would be expediting things a little. And now to the speakers. We are excited to hear all of you. The speakers will speak alphabetically. Senator Banks is currently chair of the Senate Committee on Energy, the Environment and Natural Resources. That's a hefty handful. And we're delighted he is here. He will speak first. Senator Fairbairn, always our friend, always here in Canada, a model senator for Canada, because she's here. She's also in Ottawa, but she's here most of the time, and gives us so generously of her support. We always are welcome, happy to see her here. She's a founding member of the Senate Committee on Aboriginal Peoples, and so many other things you all know about. Senator Hayes will speak on Senate reform, and we want to have a good chance to get at him. We have a professor of political science, Professor McCormick, who speaks regularly to the Council of Public Affairs to tell you the error of your ways and such other things. Enough from me, our first speaker, He's welcome here for 10 minutes to speak to you. Senator Banks.
Thank you. It's nice that there's a fellow musician as an MC. That's true. The first thing I want to do is commend you and your board, I presume it's a board, and on the existence of this organization. I don't think there's anything else in the country like it. I've never heard of any such thing, and it's a wonderful thing that every that weekly you meet and discuss matters of public policy.
You joined the Navajo Steps.
Good for you, and I wish that every community in the country would follow your excellent example. It's more Canadians need to do that. We are delighted, I'm delighted, and I know Senator Hayes is delighted to be in Senator Fairburn's home bailiwick, because I it gives me a chance to assure you of something that she probably doesn't out of modesty, which is that we don't go, I happen to be the chair of the Alberta Liberal Caucus, and we can't go 5 minutes in a meeting without Joyce Fairburn bringing up something that is absolutely cogent to this part of the country. She is like a dog with a bone when it comes to matters having to do with Southern Alberta. And you can be proud of the representation that she gives you in our place. Happily, you will learn that I'm not going to make a speech in any normal sense of the word. I also have the temerity to suggest that when it comes time to question period, as we can call this, I will happily answer any question that you have on any subject at all, as long as you're prepared to accept I don't have any idea as the answer. But we deal with a lot of things, as the chair has suggested. For example, in my committee, I also serve on the Committee of National Security and Defense. And however, the ecology and the environment and natural resources is, as the chair has suggested, a huge bailiwick. The thing which I think most immediately attends to the concerns of this part of the country is water. And I have brought with me a few copies of a fairly recent report that our committee issued called Water in the West Under Pressure, in which the recommendations that we have been making to the government for a very long time are set out rather clearly, and if any of you have any interest in that, I have a few copies with me. The problem of water in this part of the world derives essentially from the fact, as we have known since Mr. Palliser first came here and commented on it, that we don't really have a lot of it. And it is irrefutably true and that the measurable transevaporation, evapotranspiration, or whatever you want to call it, evaporation of water from this part of the world is greater every year and always has been than the precipitation that falls in this part of the world. So there is a big shortfall. And we have always made up that shortfall in this part of the world, by which I mean all the prairie provinces, from glacial melt and the spring runoff. And those things have now become less reliable than they were in the past, less certain than they were in the past, and less predictable than they were in the past. The reasons for which that is so are almost beside the point. It doesn't make any difference why the glaciers are receding. That's another question with which we can deal otherwise. What's important is that we manage the resource that we have as best we possibly can. And it happens that Alberta does a better job of managing that resource than most of our neighbors in every direction. But we have to do better. One of the things that we have to do is to internalize the cost, not just of water, but of every resource that we consume, because we don't, on any of us, pay the right cost, for example, for the water that comes out of the end of our taps. There are some places, parts of the city of Calgary, I can't tell you about the city of Lethbridge, but there are parts of the city of Calgary in which there are no water meters, for example. And so the guy who's living in this house and goes on a 3-month holiday in the summertime and is not taking a shower or washing his car every day is paying the same amount of monthly water bill as the guy next door who is watering his lawn all day every day. That is absurd, patently absurd. When we leave minuscule things like the water running while we brush our teeth, as insignificant as that seems, that is absurd. We are wasting that resource when we do that. And people who live in Switzerland, for example, when they find out that we do things like that, say, "You do what?" We all have to learn, in the largest sense, in other words, to change the way we live. We have to change the way we do business. We have to change the way we operate the things that we all take for granted. The specific immediate things like water and oil and development and the immediate off-throw of those things, mercury off-throws and noxious things that we put into the air for industrial reasons, are immediate short-term problems. The long-term problem is realizing that in order to deal with those problems, regardless of why they occur, we have to change the way we live. We have to accept the fact that those things are going to cost us more than we now pay. And until we find the political will to lead us in that direction, which has been regrettably absent from a succession of governments, we won't begin to solve those problems. We are very hopeful that this government and successive governments will move more strongly in that direction. But the long-term, taking a great step back overview, is that if we are going to address the problems which have become irrefutable, there is no longer any credible scientific opinion anywhere that seriously doubts what is happening. There are questions about why it's happening and the degree to which human activity contributes to its happening. But the fact that it is happening is no longer subject to the slightest question. It may be cyclical. It doesn't make any difference. We have to deal with it because it is happening. There are robins in the Arctic. There are plants in the Arctic for which the Inuit have no name because they've never seen them before. The glacier is receding. I'm old enough to remember driving across in the Ice Fields Parkway, the Columbia Ice Fields. We drove across the Columbia Ice Fields. The highway went across them in those days. Now you have to walk many kilometers to see that glacier. That's happening. And there is fortunately a public awareness, I believe, that is growing, and a public acceptance of the facts that these things are happening and that we must deal with them. In the long run, that's going to require that we bite a lot of bullets that we have been unused to bite. Successive governments have known this and have had at their disposal the tools and the means and the legislation. It's been in place for a long time to deal with these matters. The problem is that we, the electorate, and industries provide enormous pushback against those efforts. And so bringing them to practical use is a very difficult thing. That is why, you know, the mills of the gods grind very slowly, and these changes have to be made incrementally. We can't change the direction of the ship 90 degrees in a year. You have to change the direction of the ship a couple of degrees at a time and hope that in the event you will get to the place that you need to be in incremental steps. That is, generally speaking, the view of our committee. That is the kind of thing that we have said in our respective reports, including the one on water, which I have a few copies with me, which I hope that you will take away if you have any interest. And I thought that I would let you know that in order to inform your questions about the view of the committee and the urgings that it makes upon the government to do things. Everybody who goes to the Senate, everybody who goes to the House of Commons, everybody who works there in Ottawa every day. By the way, we are senators from the West, not from the East. We are not the Magi. We are Albertans all, and we all live in Alberta. But everybody who goes there goes with the intent of changing public, of affecting public policy. That is the purpose to which legislators dedicate themselves. I'm a relative newcomer by comparison with my two colleagues. And I have found, as you will have no difficulty understanding, great frustration in the speed with which one is able to affect public policy and to make it change and to change the direction of that ship. But every once in a while, we have a little bit of success, and it's a very gratifying thing when that happens. So I look forward very much to your questions and your interrogation and your arguments, which I hope you will make. And I thank you very much for your kind attention. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Gordon, for your kind introduction. It's always my pleasure to be here. This is my place, and you have done outstanding things, all of you in this room, to support this organization for so long. I don't think there's a place in Canada that has as well organized and as vigorous and lively discussion of public affairs as is happens here, and I congratulate you for that. I'm also delighted to have my Alberta colleagues here with me today on my home turf, of which I am so very proud. Dan and I began our Senate adventure on the very same day in 1984, and we also had been students and friends together at the University of Alberta. Tommy was making music in Edmonton those days. I had the pleasure of dancing to that music. Well, my friends, we don't do much dancing these days because, contrary to long-time mythology, we senators do indeed work. And we participate vigorously in Senate business, both in the chamber and in a variety of committees, and we are all activists back here in our home province of Alberta. As many of you may know, agriculture has always been a foundation in the work I do. It was the first committee I became attached to. I am now the chair of the Senate Agriculture and Forestry Committee, and the real urgency facing our farmers is more challenging and troubling than at any time since I began this journey. Indeed, my first cause in this area was joining with the farmers and the communities to rescue the sugar beet industry, which without notice back in the mid-1980s was shut down by Ottawa, and it just kind of happened. I don't think anyone planned it, but all of a sudden there it wasn't. And it was tough, but it was a successful effort, and it's quite ironic today that Dan and Tommy and I will be visiting those very farmers and their families during their harvest celebrations tonight in Tabor at a time once again when their industry is being challenged by pressures from the United States. And I want you to know, if they are going to go to battle again, I will definitely be marching with them. Now, over the last few years, our committee has been aggressively active in trying to communicate to government and the people the enormous pressures on our farmers and their families, and through no fault of their own, each day they are facing events over which they have little or no control. First came bovine spongiform encephalopathy, BSE, an Alberta farm, which devastated our ranchers and supportive industries and closed the U.S. border and others around the world to our cattle, and part of that border is still closed. The strength, the unity of our producers here in southern Alberta set an example for the rest of the province and indeed the country. Our senators also did substantial work on this issue, both with the cattlemen and with the government. Now, not far behind all that was the continuing attack on our grains and oilseeds farmers, both through droughts and other weather challenges, in addition to the continuing failure of the World Trade Organization to force the European community and the United States of America to pull back their subsidy programs and give others, such as Canada, a fair chance. However, there is a continuing crisis facing our farmers across this land in frustration and in fear. They have brought their voices in the thousands to Parliament Hill in the largest demonstrations I have ever seen in what I blush to admit are my 44 years working in that building. Put it all together, and it paints a grim picture for our farmers, the endless efforts to keep going for their families and for the very future of the small communities, which are the foundation of our rural strength, and also the security of our urban centers, and that includes the city of Lethbridge. As a result, with the encouragement of the government, the Senate committee has now begun a year-long challenge to help Canadians face the reality and the extent of rural poverty across this land. We are currently hearing from experts on this issue in Ottawa. Minister of Agriculture Chuck Straw was our first witness last week. And in the new year, we'll get out of the nation's capital, and we will travel from coast to coast to coast to hear from those on the ground who are struggling through no fault of their own and no fault of their families, and they are still wanting to stay on the land that they love. There is enormous strength and determination throughout rural Canada, and we hope we will be able to return with realistic evidence to convey to governments and to our urban citizens across this country who take the local supermarket for granted, and instead they aren't understanding the reality on which it is built. Knowing that our time is limited, I couldn't leave without wanting to share with you my other cause, which goes to the heart of how we live and work and raise our families to be able to fully participate in the daily life and the future of this remarkable country. I'm talking about literacy and the sad reality that what we believe is a prosperous and caring Canada, some 42% of our adult citizens, that's probably about 9 million people, are at risk every day of their life because of their inability to cope with reading and writing and numeracy and communications that the rest of us simply take for granted. I learned about this only on my very first Senate assignment crossing the country in a special committee of youth. At a time of high unemployment and the drugs and the alcohol and the pregnancies and the home difficulties, it was all there. But we heard something else in every region of this country, and we were startled to hear of the lack of literacy skills and the pain and the humiliation and the fear that go with it. For me, it became a lifelong commitment to find ways to cut in to what I believe to be, then and now, our country's hidden shame. It had not existed on Parliament Hill when I was first there, because it was deemed to be a provincial responsibility. It was education. And therefore, we had nothing of it on Parliament Hill. Well, I set out to join a group of growing advocates to see how you could build some understanding and force some change. And ladies and gentlemen, it was Brian Mulroney who took hold of this issue, and he created the first federal response, the National Literacy Secretariat, which pulled together an outstanding partnership with all provincial and territorial governments across this country, and it's worked. I pitched in to help the former Prime Minister to promote those efforts, and he cheerfully referred to me as his token Grit. In future years, I have held ministerial responsibility for literacy in the Liberal government, and all political parties have worked together as a team, and they have tried to help grow those organizations on the ground in every corner of this country where citizens live and raise their families. Today's society is governed by technology, which requires individuals of all levels to be able to read and to write in order to get a job. How many times have we read in the Lethbridge Herald and other papers recently across this country that we do not have the skilled workforce to be able to tackle the workplace of today? Progress has been made slowly but surely, thanks to organizations, and where is she, Margot Pollard, of the Read On program here in the Lethbridge Public Library, along with others here who deal with family literacy, helping their children to read, encouraging seniors to read, to use computers, giving all of us a fair chance to live a decent life. Well, within the past 2 weeks, the federal government shocked Parliament by a cutback of $17.7 million in the assistance to programs jointly provided with the provinces in communities in every corner of Canada. The phone calls I have been receiving from across this country, from learners and tutors, have been heartbreaking. Quite simply, they are frightened that their doors will close. Without the help of those on the ground that have succeeded for 18 years with a National Literacy Secretariat that no longer exists, with that, no national government has the ability to provide those opportunities alone. It has to be with partnership, and we are losing the partnership. This is not about politics. It's about generosity. It's about common sense. And I can assure you, if you get engaged here in this city, I will be marching with you every step of the way to get those who need our help back on the rails. And I believe, Gordon, that there is a petition going around somewhere here that I will be delighted to take back to Ottawa, so they'll know at least where we stand. And so on that note, my final word is thank heavens for an organization like this that allows people like me and my colleagues to tell our story.
Thank you, Gordon Campbell, and all of you who have organized this remarkable organization. A weekly meeting on public affairs is truly an impressive thing, no matter where one might find it. So to the Southern Alberta Council on Public Affairs, congratulations, and it's a delight to be with you. I'm following Senator Banks from Edmonton, my good friend, on the environment, an issue over which it's easy to become passionate and excited, and as he did, and Senator Faber, who, as she observed, started the same day in the Senate with me and others, talking about social issues and agriculture.
You were my mentor then.
Pardon?
You were my mentor.
Well, I didn't know that. Thanks, Joyce. I'm truly honored to be. But anyway, we work closely together, and she does a remarkable job. Anyway, it falls to me, environment, social, agriculture, to talk about the Constitution. So, I'll count the yawns. The Constitution is something that we have become passionate about in Alberta from time to time, and it is always on our minds, particularly in the context of the Canadian Senate. And I'm particularly pleased to be in the same room as Peter McCormick, who appeared before the Senate Special Committee looking into the government's proposal of the day, which is a step towards a reformed Senate. So you have in your community and in this organization someone who represents a huge amount of history and expertise. I see John Boris as well, and no one has been more passionate at different times about Senate reform than people like that. I thought perhaps I would maybe break my comments into three parts: a little bit about the beginnings of the Senate, which I think are very relevant to where we are today; a little bit about the role of the Senate and how it has functionally adapted to a role that was different than the one given to it in its beginnings; and then finally some words on the future, which will be my opportunity to talk about what the committee that I have the privilege of chairing is working on at this very moment, and that is a response, a parliamentary response, to Prime Minister Harper's proposal to change the time senators serve from a mandatory retirement at 75 to an 8-year renewable mandate.
The beginnings of the Senate are that it was the major preoccupation of the Fathers of Confederation. They spent more time talking about the Senate and its role, its necessity, than about any other aspect of the institutional design of our country. I'm not sure why it took so long, but in any event, at the end of the day, they decided to have a bicameral system. They thought that was necessary. I think they were very much influenced by what was happening in the United States at the time, which was going through the various aspects of the Civil War. They knew that the Westminster model that they wanted as their pattern was a bicameral system. And so they decided to have an appointed Senate, and actually phased out elected councils in the United Canadas, the provinces that eventually became Canada. They wanted it to serve as a safeguard against the popularly elected House in terms of what it might do that would need to be scrutinized carefully and, if necessary, checked. So, appointed, powerful. They gave it the same powers as the House of Commons, except in matters of money bills, that is, spending and borrowing of money. But they gave it the power to defeat bills and amend those expenditures or borrowings downward. And there it is. And it's turned out pretty much, I think, as they thought it would. It has been a body that has the power to operate as a check on the decisions of the House of Commons and on the executive branch of government. It has done that from time to time, but it has not done it very often. And that is because, as an appointed body, it has traditionally been in a deferential position, a complementary position, if you will, to the House of Commons, rather than a competitive position, which is the classic example of that would be the U.S. bicameral structure in the U.S. Senate. The special interest of the day was property interest, was the elite of the day. You had to have, and still do, $4,000 worth of property, free and clear. You can't be bankrupt. You have to be at least 30 years of age, and so on. So that's the beginning. The way in which the Senate has evolved is that it has gone from that beginning and has adapted or functionally evolved into a body which at the present time has one of the highest percentages of women of any legislative body in a democratic country. It has more Aboriginals than the House of Commons as a percentage, Inuit, Montagnier, and other Aboriginals. And in fact, of special interest to you is that the first Aboriginal, the first Indian to serve in the Parliament of Canada came from this area, Senator Gladstone. It is also representative of the diversity of the country, its ethnic diversity, and the diversity of the various communities which make up the country. The usual list of lawyers, but it has musicians, it has journalists, it has hockey players, it has people who are in the theater, who represent, as I say, a broad spectrum of the diversity and interests that should be in a parliamentary body and voice the special concerns and objectives of those communities. To the future, we've had, I'm told, at least 30 attempts to reform the Senate, starting in 1874. The first proposal for an elected Senate was, I think, very early in the 20th century. I've forgotten the date. I'm not sure why, but none of these have produced any results. The only changes to the Senate from the beginning are that instead of serving for life, you have to retire at 75. And in 1982, the Senate's constitutional veto on certain constitutional change, specifically the Senate itself, were taken away, and it was given a 6-month suspensive veto. The last attempt on comprehensive reform was the Charlottetown Accord. In 1992, it was defeated. It contained a proposal for a Senate with equal numbers from each province, powers that were constrained, the suggestion of a type of proportional representation, and a number of things were not fleshed out. But in any event, it was turned down, and as someone observed, and often observed when we talk about that, it was packaged with other things, namely the desire to address the Quebec grievance from 1982. As you know, they didn't sign on as a province, although a majority of their MPs of the day did. And it also had provisions that went some way to recognizing the inherent right to self-government that Aboriginal peoples wanted. Senators have, and certainly your Alberta representatives, have been interested in and supportive of Senate reform. And you can read into that some type of elected Senate, because I think when you have a discussion of the Senate and Senate reform, that's where you have to end up.
1 minute.
I didn't know there was a timer, but thanks, Gordon. In 1 minute, then, Stephen Harper has it in his mind that comprehensive reform has shown no success. Maybe there's some way of having step-by-step reform, and he has decided to proceed with what he acknowledges is the easiest step, and that is addressing the terms. It leaves unaddressed election, distribution of seats, and appropriate powers, because if we do have an elected Senate, it will not be in the model of the one at the beginning as an appointed body, which has become which has always been deferential to the House of Commons and increasingly to premiers who have taken on the role of regional representation. So is this a good idea? We have heard from a number of people, experts, and there's been no real criticism of the idea of limited terms for senators. Maybe not 8 years. 8 years suits an elected Senate very well, but not necessarily an appointed Senate, which is what we may end up with, whether we want to or not, because the next steps may not be possible. So I'll leave it at that, and I'll look forward to your questions. It's a great pleasure to be with you.
Moderator Gordon, I'd like to start out by thanking these three senators from Alberta for being here with us today. I think we've been really enriched by their presentations from all three of them. Having said that, this morning was watching the History Channel, where they gave a very, very lucid picture of Passchendaele and what led up to Passchendaele and what happened to Canadian troops there and so on, which triggers a question in my mind. What does a Senate as a whole think about our entry into the war? I will say, on a personal note, that I supported our Canadian troops being in Afghanistan on a peacekeeping basis. I was amazed and surprised that suddenly we're at war, fully at war with a foreign country. And what I'd like to ask is, how does the Senate fit into the decision-making process for Canadians to go to war? And where does the Senate fit in, and where do we as the public fit in?
Would you want to speak to that question?
Whoever wishes to answer it, I won't address that to anyone specifically. Tom, yes.
Well, I think that we could all speak to that question, and you might hear three entirely different answers, at least opinions. Then I will speak first, because I happen to be one of the original members of the Standing Senate Committee on National Security and Defense, and I will try to express that committee's view. It's always a good idea with things like that to reduce the question to the simplest possible dimension, and the idea that Canadians have about peacekeeping implies and in fact demands that there be a peace to keep. Okay? And there was a time when we were very good at that, when the warring parties had been moved apart by whatever reason, usually a resolution of some kind, and an agreement by both parties, and needed merely to be kept apart by people with nice blue hats on and who could say, now, boys, you know, and not much more than that. And we were very good at peacekeeping, and we were at one time, a long time ago, at the top of the list in our contributions in numbers of people to peacekeeping. But with very few exceptions in the world now, in some of which there are still Canadians doing that job, there is no peace to keep. You're right that when we first went to Afghanistan, and it was the government of Jean Chrétien that essentially determined that we would, it was in a less belligerent role than we now find ourselves. It was to go to Kabul, which is the capital, and to help maintain it as a sort of island in a country in which there was otherwise not peace and stability. And we did that for a while. But the reports that came back from both the civilian people who were there with our armed forces and from the armed forces themselves were that somebody needs to go outside of this fortress, in effect. Because there are belligerents out there. And absent doing something about that, there can never be a definable peace to keep. So we have moved consciously, and as a matter of Canadian public policy, and not anything else, from peacekeeping, in a sense, to peacemaking. And sometimes, and again I'm reducing things to the simplest dimension here that I can, sometimes peacemaking consists in saying to someone, be peaceful, or I will kill you. Sometimes, and you talked about Passchendaele, and there are lots of other examples in which we have had to sometimes go to that extreme. That is what we're doing in Afghanistan. And Canada is now embarked on a very strong diplomatic efforts to convince our NATO neighbors that they must belly up to the bar in the way that we have, because save the Americans, except with the exception of the Americans in Afghanistan, we have been carrying the brunt of carrying the fight to the bad guys, to put it most simply. It's not that we're at war with a country. We are there at the invitation of the government of Afghanistan, which is an elected government. And we are there to protect that government against people who wish to depose it and impose a different kind of regime. We've determined as a matter of Canadian policy to do that. There never used to be a question when we were in the war in which Passchendaele was such an important part, and in which Vimy was such an important part, and then subsequently in which Dieppe and Italy and the Netherlands were such important parts that Canadians participated in. We were never in a situation where our neighbors had vastly different orders of engagement than we do. But there are NATO countries who have said, as we once did in Afghanistan, yes, we'll send some soldiers, but they can only do this. They can't do that. That makes it very difficult. And our argument at the moment is with our other NATO allies to say, we've done our turn. You guys need to now to change your terms of engagement and come and do this for a while we go sit up north where there isn't a big problem and have a bit of a rest.
This is a dangerous topic to comment on because of the way in which Canadians and parliamentarians are divided on the issue of our presence in Afghanistan. Just very quickly, the origins of this problem go back to 1979, which I've heard said is as important a turning point in history as 1989, the fall of the Soviet Union. 1979 was the year in which Russia moved into Afghanistan to bring it within its sphere of influence, and we all know the ultimate result of that was that they were driven out by the jihadis with the help of the U.S. and others. Also the year of the Iranian Revolution, which is very much in the news to this day in terms of what has flowed from that. The U.S. have had sanctions on since 1979. So what transpired, I guess, in Afghanistan, we're all familiar with in terms of that became the country governed by a fairly extreme group of a Muslim group, the Taliban, who are not, I don't think, by anyone's measure, representative of Islam, at least the one that I am familiar with and have come to know. Without getting into that, the thing that they did that
attracted adverse attention was to host the Al-Qaeda group and to refuse to cooperate with the international community in eliminating Al-Qaeda from Afghanistan. And the result was the UN-approved NATO invasion, which saw the Taliban removed. There were other distractions at the time, and I think Iraq plays into this, and I think it's very important to remember this is not Iraq. Iraq has a different genesis and didn't have the same relationship to 9/11 that Afghanistan did because of the Al-Qaeda presence there. And we are now, as Canadians, seeing the very high cost of peacemaking, robust peacemaking. And as Senator Banks pointed out, we're not at war with anyone. We are attempting to reinstate a situation where the duly elected executive, president, and parliament of Afghanistan can govern. And I think it's too soon to give up on that. And I don't like the idea of giving up on that, and would be supportive of, and am supportive of, a continued presence that Canada participates in. We need to do more to bring in other NATO allies. The government has an important role to play there. I was very disappointed in the comments of Pervez Musharraf, where he indicated that Canada was basically not very serious about it. We'd had four or five casualties, and they'd had 500. I mean, that demonstrates that we are not in contact with that important country. And they, of course, have this incredibly important role to play in whether or not we will be successful in Afghanistan. So we need to work on Pakistan. We need to work on the objectives in Afghanistan. And the hope is that we will be successful, and we'll go day by day in terms of what our views are, and ultimately what our decision is.
Joyce, you want to start? Sure, just briefly.
Yes, I will be brief. I think I'm up here because of what Van said as he was talking about Passchendaele. I just within a short period of time since my aunt died, which many of you in this room would know, Kathleen Young, I was going through a lot of stuff in the house. And I came across a diary. And as also some of you may know, my father, Lynn Fairbairn, was killed in a riding accident when I was six. So I didn't have a long time with him. But the time I had, I learned more from him than I've ever learned in my life. And I've always thought that I knew little about his military background, but I always thought it was Passchendaele. However, I found out, much to my surprise, and it was eerie. It was almost like a presence in a room.